everybody, and welcome to another edition of Talking TV with Ryan and Ryan, with your host, Ryan McGee from BoobTubeDude.com, Maureen Mo Ryan from AOL, and our special guest this week from Time Magazine, James Poniewozik. James, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we haven't, it's been a long time. We used to have you quite a bit on Orientation Ryan Station back in the lost days, and we're glad to have you here. This podcast is going to be entirely about Mad Men. A little bit later in the week, Mo and I are going to preview some of the shows that we are looking forward to most in the fall season. But for this episode, we're going to be talking entirely Mad Men. This week's episode, Waldorf Stories. And just to start off, James, I know a lot of people kind of know, if they follow the podcast, they pretty much know how Mo and I feel about the season so far, but just a quick summary of how you think the season stands up six episodes in.
I don't entirely know. I mean, it's wishy-washy, but you have to say, you know, on an episode-by-episode basis, I have by and large been enjoying the episodes. I think, you know, the show's got a strong voice. I think definitely for the first run of three or four episodes, I thought it was, you know, hitting really strongly. I thought that raising the stakes by following through on Don and Betty's divorce, invigorated the show, because one choice you can do with that is to, you know, bring them to the verge of splitting up and, you know, not do it endlessly. I think it helped the show that it committed to that. I think that the sort of the change in period and the change in offices has kind of given the show a bit of almost, kind of a relaunch feel to it. Mm-hmm. So, I think the individual elements have been working pretty strongly. I'm still kind of waiting to see what it's all going to add up to, which, you know, I think, and again, this is wishy-washy, but in a show that is very, very highly serial like Mad Men, you kind of have to do that on a season-by-season basis. Right. I mean, I remember one, you know, reservation I had starting off was you know, there was this idea that the theme of this season is going to be who is Donald Draper and identity. And I often admit, when I heard that, I thought, that seems like the stupidest idea for a theme that I've ever heard. Not the stupidest idea, but you could say that it's the theme of any show about characters ever in the history of stories about people. You know, I mean,
right,
they're
right.
All about identity. They're all about, you know, yeah, I was worried. You know, was worried that it was going to kind of amble along. I think so far the individual stories, you know, have generally been pretty strong for me. I have particularly liked the way the show has kind of broken down Don, and, you know, brought him to this low and often, you know, contemptible point. As to what, you know, my big question is still, you know, what it's sort of all aiming toward, you know, in terms of the larger arc of the season. There are individual quibbles that I have that I suspect we'll probably get to in in our talk, but I don't want to monopolize too much of the time.
Sure. I mean, Mo, have you felt that the season has led out of that question, that for who is Dom Draper, or is it gone well past that, and where is your interest currently lying as you're watching the shows?
Well, I really think it's very strong. To me, it feels like we're getting the second half of the season now, which I really, really enjoy, because I think there's been a slow burn quality to the first and second halves of seasons in general, and the show has kind of had different paces at different times. Having said that, I think, you know, there's been a lot going on. I love the unpredictability of it. I love the fact that so many times we are living in opposite world, you know, that Pete is the voice of reason. Peggy is the one who's cleaning up Don's messes. And, you know, everything is upside down, and yet it makes sense that it's that way. You know, society's not only changing, but everything's changing for these people as individuals, and they've put a lot of those changes in motion themselves. So how that all collides and how that reformulates is all very interesting to me. I think it's interesting what James was saying, because I'm going to be on record as of Wednesday of saying this is my favorite season so far, mainly because we have so much history with these people, and there's that element of excitement and the depth of character study that we look for, yet the sort of the momentum of it all. But I feel like this could, in a weird way, be the season of the epic fail if it doesn't go anywhere interesting. I think that's why James' point is very well taken, that the bigger you go, the more you have to pay it off. And this is really Mad Men going for the gold, I feel. And it could be a very harsh landing if, you know, in episodes 12 and 13, it kind of just peters out or doesn't resolve in a way that really makes you feel like everything that happened in the first half of the season needed to happen and was you know, led up to something.
Sure. And that question of who is Don Draper got a significant twist this week, where we got some backstory, which Mad Men used to do quite a lot of, especially around season two when they were trying to fill in the gaps between season one and season two, what happened with Peggy's pregnancy, so forth and so on. We went really far back to the first meeting between Don and Roger, and we learned a lot about how Don started as Sterling Cooper in the first place, and there were heavy hints, and I want to hear your sort of opinions on this. I mean, can we safely assume that Don never got an official job offer from Roger Sterling? James?
That was my take on it. It was funny because I wrote about the Emmys last night, and then I caught up on my Mad Men post this morning, and I kind of dashed it off maybe a little faster than I usually do. And I had never assumed, it wasn't until I started reading other commentary online that I saw that some other people had thought, this was maybe this, you know, head fake or whatever, but obviously Roger had offered him the job and just hadn't remembered it. And no, I thought it seemed both in keeping with the themes of the series and with the cues that we were given from this particular story that, you know, after all that, it wasn't really, you know, Don's stick-to-itiveness or his talent or whatever that got him the job, but he basically got his foot in the door by conning his way in. I thought one key to that was that it certainly seemed that the last we saw him speaking with Roger Sterling in the flashback at their meeting at the bar where, you know, Roger was hammered, Roger seemed entirely prepared to kiss Don off. So I thought that was the signal we were being sent. I guess I also just sort of like it better that way. I like this notion, although it works well either way. I like this notion that their relationship is kind of based on this mutually agreed on founding myth.
Yeah,
the lie, you know, agreed upon.
Don gets to behave as though he pulled himself up by, you know, his bootstraps and impressed Roger with his work and made himself that way. And Roger gets to believe that he had the acumen to see the talent in this nobody and brought him up out of nowhere.
Mo, do you agree with James's statement? And what do you think Don Draper's current memory of that incident is? Has he created for himself that he got the job offer, or is he still aware that his entire foundation is probably just a lie?
I think he absolutely invented that job offer to Roger, and Roger was not in a position to really remember exactly what transpired at that lunch. I completely am in the camp of thinking that Don never got an offer. I mean, on this show, not a lot of important things. I guess some important things happen off stage, but this is a case where I think Don did what he had to do to get ahead. I mean, he stole the whole guy's identity. At that point, faking a job offer is not going to really faze him, and he really, really wanted this, and he knew that he could maneuver Roger into a position where he didn't necessarily have a choice in bringing him on board. So,
also,
to me, I feel like, you know, this is of a piece with the Don Draper I know. He absolutely would have done that, and he had a mark, and he played him, and honestly, everything he's achieved since then has been on the up and up. So, although I do think that maybe I'm jumping ahead here, but what James pointed out in his post and others have as well, that, you know, that very hungriness is kind of eluding Don at this point. I mean, he seems to be just almost contemptuous of the process at this point when he's not just lazy or, you know, unfocused. He's just not really, he needs to be on his A game, and that pitch with Life Serial proved that he's on, like, his, you know, G game.
Right.
He's just lucky that they liked a really lame pitch that he accidentally stole from someone.
Right, you had a follow-up there, James?
Two things. Number one, I also think that it makes sense. Not only that, you know, Don saw his mark, as you said, Mo, but, you know, Dick Whitman knew a thing or two about drunks, you know, yeah. How they behave and what you can put over on them. So in terms of his history, that interpretation of it makes more sense to me, too. And, yeah, I really liked that scene with the live serial pitch. For the reason, as you alluded to, as I mentioned in my post, was that it recalled several scenes in which we've seen Don behave more competently in the office. In particular, he gets up there drunk in front of the live serial people and says, "So anyway, I was thinking about nostalgia and blah 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 and cereal." And when he makes that reference to nostalgia, that's, you know, a clear callback to that great moment at the end of season one where mm-hmm. he makes the Kodak pitch. And he talks about nostalgia and learning from his old boss, the fur company, that nostalgia is from the Greek, meaning a pain from an old wound, and gives just this absolutely eloquent speech, maybe one of the most beautiful scenes there's ever been on that show, and certainly Don at his best as we ever seen him as a salesman. And now we see he's literally become a parody of himself.
Absolutely.
We've seen Don when he was brilliant, and now he's trying to pass off one of his old hits, and it's just become shtick.
Yeah,
I agree. Yeah.
He has become kind of a joke of himself.
And do you think that he's aware of that? Do you think that he's consciously... I mean, I think he's just kind of in the bag and not really thinking these things through. He obviously didn't think through pitching clients while completely wasted. But, you know, do you think he's aware of what a parody of himself has become, even creatively? I mean, as a man, he has to be aware that people in the office think he's something of a joke anymore. But do you think he gets that he's essentially taking his own past and making a joke of it? And it's so sad to me on some level.
I guess, I mean, to me, I was thinking more along the lines of almost Spinal Tap, where there has to get a point where, like, the aging rock stars keep playing their old hits and thinking they're still, like, in the prime of their youth and... something has to happen to sort of snap them into place that calls into, you know, question their own sort of perspective on reality. And when we talk about the sort of progression of the season, where is it going? With Don's lost weekend, can we safely say this is the bottom for him and then we're going to arc up or arc at least in a different direction? Or is there still, like, new depths for this guy to plumb?
I don't know. I mean, to me, there are always, I'm always seeing parallels to The Sopranos and the way it treated its characters in Mad Men, rightly or wrongly. And, you know, I think that Don Draper is not exactly like Tony Soprano. But I do think that one thing that he does have in common with him is just his ability not to learn. I mean, it seems to me, you know, and I remember that the fourth season of Sopranos was, you know, it had a fair amount of great seemingly hitting bottom stuff for Tony, and that was when his marriage with Carmela was seeming to fall apart and so on. But I tend to think that, you know, Don has seemed pretty capable in the past of finding a new bottom, and you know, I don't know why he couldn't now.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that. I think that it's interesting. Earlier today, I was rewatching earlier episodes because I, you know, plan to publish on my site my new home, the sort of magnum opus in the last four episodes, because I get a lot of comments every day of like, "Where's your Batman post?" And I'm, you know, Twitter's become kind of my agony at this point.
Right.
But in a good way. Everyone who's tweeted me, I love you. So I was watching that scene where he goes to visit Anna in California, and it's interesting to me that there's a time lapse night for Don there as well, night and today, where he's absorbing the news that she has cancer and he's going to lose her. And then we get this time lapse of Don's lost day, which was really more scary. And I think I'd be interested to get your takes on, I mean, that episode takes an absolute turn, and maybe the turn begins when, you know, Roger starts down the self-pity moroseness route at the bar, and Joan very correctly calls him on that. It just seems like the episode took this turn from this sort of jollity, some of it a little bit antic or manic or not necessarily forced, but just a little bit much into this real sadness and just horrible, you know, darkness of like, wow, there's someone in my bed. I cannot remember her name. I have to look at her waitress uniform. That's low. That's dark, you know?
Yeah.
So it's interesting to me. I feel like those two long nights of the soul are really connected. Those two time lapse moments to me feel more connected, maybe just to me, but because the sadness of losing Anna, I think, is and just losing this last link to something that feels very real to him is, I think, driving a certain amount of this behavior. You know, I really think, as much as we say he's become a joke, and he has, not only is society changing around him, not only are women like Allison changing and younger staff thinking he's kind of a joke, the guy's also endured a lot of loss. You know, his marriage is broken up. Obviously, he has this toxic relationship still with his wife that's affecting their children. Now he's going to lose Anna. And it's just, this is a guy who's found it hard to be real and sustain relationships with people, and he's being absolutely hammered in all directions. So, I mean, it's not like, well, Don is justified in all of his antics, but at the same time, he's been through a lot, and I think that I have to say that given that Anna's death is still to come, I wonder how far off the rails he goes when that actually happens.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. If you think about, you know, with Anna in the time lapse, I mean, the good news, that episode had an episode that was kind of morose, did the time lapse, and kind of went into Jolly Land with Lane and the Gomro and all that sort of stuff that was going on. And here was the reverse, but it's interesting what Doris, the waitress, thinks his name is. I mean, apparently during his last day of, you know, orders of fries, he called himself Dick. And you have to wonder about if he was trying to sort of subconsciously project Anna mm-hmm. onto this waitress through the blurry sort of, you know, lens of his drunken stare during that.
Yep.
Yeah, go ahead, James.
I'm sorry?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were... I
think it was Mo. I think you heard Mo.
Well, I actually have a question for you guys. You know, Don has gone to this... You know, we've seen all season that he's not obviously this enigmatic, reserved, you know, guy who everyone looks up to. I mean, the change in him over four seasons now is really radical, and I really respect that, and I really enjoy that. As James was saying, I agree with that assessment. But do you think that there's a point at which they have to stop, or it's just too much? You know, because, I don't know, maybe part of the... I mean, I liked in the episode with the caper with Ted Chau and the motorcycle and the Honda people, the chrysanthemum and the sword. I loved Don being good at his job or being good at something. I mean, I really feel like they threw the fans a bone in some ways by saying, you know, yeah, he still has his mojo when he chooses to use it. Do you guys think that there's a point at which they just can't, you know, they can't turn him into Freddie Rumsen, you know, like basically, you know, freelancing around town and, you know, just the sad sack. What do you guys think?
Well, my thing about this, I don't think they're making Don pathetic. I mean, you know, although I think, you know, some of the people around, like the younger people around his office might see him that way, and he seems that way in, you know, many of the moments that he's had here. But, you know, I don't think that there's this split that, again, as I wrote about this episode this week, that it's either he's you know, loser Don or winner Don, and winner Don triumphs over loser Don. I think what this episode was showing was how, you know, winner Don is they coexist. They're two sides of the same coin, and a winner Don kind of enables and pays the bills for loser Don. I mean, I think that one thing that you can see in this episode, Waldorf stories, after he wins the Clio Award, is you can almost just literally see John Hamm swelling. He's like becoming, you know, it engorged through the episode with this kind of sense of entitlement.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't need to share the credit. And, you know, he doesn't, you know, thank everybody that he might thank. And, of course, he should be praised. And, of course, he should be celebrated. And, of course, he should be able to walk up to any woman he wants and, you know, claim sex for his reward. You know, and that's kind of, you know, an exaggerated version of the Don we've seen in the past. But on the other hand, I don't know. I don't need to like Don Draper. I don't think that right. like, we have from episode one of this show been meant to see Don Draper as, you know, an entirely admirable guy, although, you know, he may have redeeming qualities. So, I mean, I would put myself as one of the people, put myself down as, like, one of the people who does not need, like, you know, light, triumphant, you know, feel-good moments from Mad Men.
No, I don't need that. I just wonder how much... I mean, some of the enjoyment of the show for me is seeing Don be good at what he does and wondering how he pulls that from his life. And, you know, some of the characters I've loved the most have been dark, really scary, killer, bad people, you know?
Yeah.
So I just wonder, you know, there's the aspect of Don where he's good at stuff, you know, and it doesn't have to be necessarily that he's good at betting women or being a friend or being a father. I mean, just one of those things I think he needs for me, I guess. I guess I'm going to come out and say, I think for me, he needs to be good at something some of the time, once in a while. Oh, you know, I wonder if that would be too radical of a change for him to be failing on all fronts pretty much a lot of the time.
But isn't part of the idea implicit in this season that he is very good at a lot of things and that he's actually reaped the rewards of being good at a lot of things? I mean, he successfully engineered the split from Sterling Cooper and, you know, is a partner in his own ad shop, you know, in the Time Life building. And he's, you know, he's a much more talked about figure in his own industry. And he's just won, you know, Clio Award,
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I just, you know, to me, it's more about how, the guy who's, you know, the Don Draper who is good at things, sort of makes, kind of provides the, you know, the justification or the sense of self-entitlement, for Don the Bastard.
Yeah.
And it also helps the fact that, like, even in his office, even if the younger generation may not be looking up to him, Roger still holds him to a certain level that he cannot put himself upon. That he sees Don very much as a, you know, a cut from a different cloth, as it were. And I think sort of, you know, all you have to do is look at Roger trying to write his memoirs, and all he can come up with is sort of vanilla ice cream versus chocolate to avoid stains. And
yeah.
He desperately wants to be that sort of creative figure, and he both admires Don and hates his freaking guts. And they play that out a lot more in season two necessarily than for now, but there is that sort of simmering tension. And I almost wonder how, you know, Roger would take it if he ever learned the sort of truth of the myth. And I think you're right about the myth of Don for some people is still very potent. I mean, for Roger and John, I think, as James, you pointed out, the time for change may be over. There may be some sort of fossilization there, especially in an era that is increasingly changing. So maybe this is a good way to segue and ask you, James, is it just Don that can change the people of his generation, or what do you think about sort of Pete and Peggy and their ability to sort of, you know, adjust to the situations and the times around them?
I think that Pete's a really interesting figure in this regard, because I think that one way that the show has always kind of interestingly characterized him is that he's both, you know, kind of the link to this old, you know, Brahmin blue blood New York past, and at the same time, he's been one of the most kind of, you know, socially forward thinking people on the staff of Sterling Cooper and now Sterling Cooper Draper Price. You know, Pete particularly seems to have this. This ability to will himself to become the kind of person that he needs to be to gain advantage in a situation. I think that's an advantage that Pete's got going for him. And Peggy likewise, although, you know, I think her, you know, modus operandi is very different.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me to see those characters evolve, and I think that's one of the things I really respect about the show a lot at this point, that they're willing to take the characters in different directions and show their evolutions. And for a lot of the characters, not just Don, you can say season four versus season one, they're different people. But I guess the question of the show really is, how different are they really inside? So that's kind of like what's most compelling about Don for me. But I think maybe character doesn't change, but modus operandi changes. I don't really know. Or maybe character itself or human nature can be tweaked. I'm not sure. But certainly in Peggy's case, Peggy and Pete are so from the same cloth, which is why I think they have that ongoing bond that will never really be broken, or I hope is never broken, because they're very pragmatic. And talk about coming from opposite ends of the spectrum. You know, she comes from a lower middle class, maybe working class family, in Brooklyn, and a Catholic, you know, very traditional conservative family. But maybe in a way, the tightness of that community or the rule-bound nature of that community is very similar in some way to Pete's world, and that he comes from this WASP world where, you know, people summer at, you know, these designated places, and you go to these designated schools, and, you know, everyone kind of follows the same rituals. So they really have a good sense of what they're good at, and they don't allow things to get in their way. And I love to see what we used to see with Don is how's Don going to solve the problem? You know, I remember when Pete was going to out him to Bert Cooper as, you know, he's really Dick Whitman, and he lied, and he's this, you know, scam artist kind of guy. Don had to solve the problem, and he still does that. Obviously, he can really pull that off. But, you know, both Pete and Peggy are really learning that skill. And Pete's no longer a petulant guy. He's found a way to solve the problem. I think Trudy is actually an incredible help to him in that regard. She is kind of has that Joan side of her where she says, okay, let's just have you take it down a notch, and here's the practical solution to the problem. And, you know, she doesn't really put up with a lot of his BS. So I love to see, you know, them solve problems and move forward, and especially this week with the Peggy storyline, I found that hilarious. You know, I felt like it was just, the show has gone to these dark places, and at the same time, does it strike you as it's also kind of fun? It's really funny, and I think there's a lot of debate about Miss Blankenship, but they're deploying her just enough to not be super overly sitcom-y for me. But I'm just finding there's a lot of humor in these episodes.
Yeah, Mrs. Blankenship is sitcom-y for me. I mean, I think that Mad Men has always been a hilarious show. You know, I think that, like, a lot of, you know, the best dramas from the past 10 years, it is also, at the same time, one of the funniest shows on TV. You know, I think that you know, the great thing about Mad Men is that its humor has, you know, generally, you know, it's been sort of very, very wry and kind of arising out of situation and ironies, or people not entirely being aware of what they're saying, or people knowing that they were saying something very, you know, witty and saying it. When I see something like this, the scenes with Mrs. Blankenship, it just, the thing that bugs me, maybe sitcom-y is the wrong word, although it does seem that some of her stuff could almost be accompanied by a laugh track.
Right.
But it's also like the rhythms just suddenly become the rhythms of a different show. Some of the Chrysanthemum and the Sword was like this for me as well, although I know people loved that episode. But I almost had the feeling at times that, like, I was listening to somebody who was writing a spec script for Mad Men, who was writing a very funny show that was just slightly different, and the voices of the characters were somewhat different.
Right.
And you know, it was another show that might have been good, but didn't really comport with, you know, what Mad Men was most of the time.
Right. And James, I think I definitely agree with you that I thought last week was a bit too much of her, although I think everyone's in universal agreement that her best moment this week happened off screen when Don set up Danny to take the verbal abuse from her, saying, I don't work for you.
That's
a good use of her.
I think that's a great use of her. I agree. I mean, I think it's one of those things that it's like, a certain spice in cooking, you don't want to overuse it or it becomes really horrible. You know, it can just become,
I think a lot of Peggy's humor comes from a fact that she's now, you know, we talk a lot of this, you look at the episode and I try to compare it to sort of, you know, looking at the corporate ladder, and you can go up the corporate ladder, but at a certain point the corporate ladder ends. There's only so many rungs of it you can go off before you're sort of pushed off. And I love watching Peggy and Pete, because they're both climbing this ladder, looking up and wondering if that's where they actually sort of want to go. And Don and Roger can't help but think the next person down the pipe is the one who's going to replace them. If you look at Danny, there's very little to differentiate Danny from the initial Don Draper, which is saying, you know, a lot about sort of where they all sort of, you know, start out in that case. But I was really interested in sort of, you know, Peggy's expression of her sexuality. I know, Mo, you talked about going back to some episodes. I was going back to the Maiden Form episode. Because I was looking at, that's one of the first episodes in which Peggy tries to sort of explore her sexuality in a very male-dominated aspect, male-dominated world. And that's the episode where they had the sort of Jackie Marilyn debate,
mm-hmm.
the sort of virgin whore. And I wonder if she's trying to find some sort of, you know, third way, not only in terms of her business acumen, but in terms of the way that she treats her body. Because it's not the virgin or the whore that she's showing off. When she gets naked in front of Stan, that it's not a sexual thing per se. I mean, she's using her body. Anyway, I've rambled on enough about this. James, what did you make of that scene where they were pitching, trying to get the VIX thing done in the hotel over the weekend?
I think the challenge that Peggy has been confronted with and that she's figured out how to deal with is that, you know, she's realized she is going to be a woman in the workplace no matter what. You know, her gender is going to be an issue. Her sexuality is going to be an issue no matter. It's not like, it's not something that, you know, maybe like the Peggy of the first season, you know, she can just, you know, throw sweaters on top of and you know, people won't notice that she's a woman. And she's increasingly, you know, come into situations and figured out how to deal with situations in which she can either use her gender as an asset or somebody, as in the case with Rizzo this week, is going to try to use it against her, right? Because basically here's this guy who's, you know, reading Playboy in front of her and trying to present, you know, his, you know, supposed sexual liberation as basically a bludgeon against her. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, he's posing as the open-minded one, and she's the prude, but he's basically using this to make just, you know, the most utterly kind of misogynistic attack against her and manipulate her. And you know, what she needs to do here is somebody say, you know, fine, I'm going to own this. This is a situation where I'm being challenged, and I have to call this guy's bluff. And show that I have the greater level of comfort here.
And I think what she did was really follow Don's advice that, you know, she does need to learn how to manage people, especially if she wants to ascend that ladder. She really needs to figure out, okay, I have to treat this person in this way. I have to call this, you know, bozo on his complete, you know, bullshit attitude, frankly. You know, he's just really getting in her face and aggressively won't respond until he feels a modicum of respect for her. And he's aggressively trying to, you know, basically, I don't know, make her cry or something, but he's just being a complete jerk. And even despite that, they have some common ground. I mean, I think they both feel disgruntled. They both feel like their work is not appreciated. You know, they're really good at what they do, or that's what they think anyway, and they're not getting recognized for it. So, I don't know if she's able to view him sort of as a colleague in that sense, but she's learning the art of, you don't just treat everyone the same way as if they're coming off an assembly line. You have to figure out how to play individuals. I mean, as Joan memorably tried to do with Lane, offering to get him some fried chicken, that totally backfired. And Joan usually knows exactly how to play people. But that's what the whole show is about. How do you find a way through somebody's armor? How do you get the upper hand? And I don't know, Danny just not seem to have the right stuff at all. But you know what? He used what he had, and that's what the show is about. In some ways, it's just almost using your you know, everyone has flaws, everyone has things holding them back. It's how do you use what you do have to your advantage?
Absolutely. And a couple of weeks ago, we had the parallel between Pete and Peggy where, you know, Pete's banging his head against a pole, and later on, Peggy bangs her head against a desk. And just as the compare contrast, just as Peggy, you know, psychologically beats Rizzo this week, Pete also seems to at least psychologically beat Ken who strolls in trying to think things are going to be the way they were. Although, James, you weren't so convinced that Ken was actually beaten in that scene, were you?
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll have to see how it plays out, but wasn't the dynamic all, you know, between them, like during the bake-off last season, that, you know, Pete's strategy was, you know, I mean, Pete would stew and get very agitated about things and make aggressive moves and, you know, hatch plots. And Ken was the person who acted, at least, as if everything rolled right off of him.
Right.
But you know, he was sort of this amoeba who would just absorb your attacks and then figure out a way to redirect your energy against you. So it's possible that Pete has won out and he is indeed now and forever the alpha dog in this situation. But it also strikes me that the way Ken reacted yesterday is exactly the way that the Ken who had competed against Pete before would have reacted. Yeah, whatever. He's gonna yes him to death.
Yeah.
But ultimately, he's going to do what he wants to do.
Yeah, I think in that situation, Ken is very astute. He's very savvy politically. I think even more so after, you know, some unhappy times away from the old gang. And he realizes that Pete needs to feel that he's won. And he needs to probably feel that for some time. But I totally agree that he's the guy that appears not to care, and that is his thing. And he does really, really well. Despite people, you know, Pete stewing and Pete attacking. I do think it'll be interesting, though, to see a dynamic in which it's the new Pete. It's not necessarily the Pete of yore where he would just kind of act out and lash out and, you know, not necessarily have a game plan. So somewhat chastened Ken Cosgrove and a somewhat more mature Pete Campbell could have a really interesting dynamic going forward. And that's another thing that I'm really enjoying about the season is how these different people are coming together as, and they're different, you know, as much as Roger says he's the same person, and I think he is, which is kind of unfortunate in some ways. These characters are coming at each other in new ways because they've kind of altered their worldview or their modus operandi.
Yeah, and
although I'm not entirely one thing I would take a little exception is I'm not entirely convinced that Pete has necessarily evolved much.
Really?
Because I think there are certain patterns of behavior that we've seen from him over and over again, that I think this was an example of. He reacted at first petulantly, and then he took a moment to regroup, and he came back with sort of a very aggressive, surprise move in which he gained advantage for himself. And I think that has been the way Pete has worked for a long time. He's this creature of old privilege who, you know, sort of grew up in, you know, the WASP aristocracy or whatever, and still uses that as much as he can, you know, his old school ties or whatever to make business contacts and things like that. But he realizes that now, whether he likes it or not, he's living in a meritocracy. And has to scrap for himself that way. But, you know, I think that, you know, the sort of bold, you know, attack move by Pete is, you know, that's just, this is a more successful variation of, you know, what he did, what, you know, he tried to do, you know, against Don in season one. It's the same sort of, you know, strategy that he took with his father-in-law, which was going
with
him. And then suddenly, you know, catching him in a vulnerable moment and upping the ante and saying, well, I'm going to take this and this and this from you.
Yeah.
And there's nothing. And, you know, and it's also, you know, how we've seen him act in his personal life. And, you know, I mean, let's not forget, you know, he may be forward thinking in a lot of ways, but he still raped a girl last year. You know,
yeah.
He's not, you know, I'm not necessarily convinced that it's a much more evolved Pete Campbell that we're seeing now.
Well, I think he's picking his battles a lot more smartly. I think that's what's happening is that, you know, he's figuring out that the all-out frontalist attack without having thought it through is a bad, bad idea, and Don will beat them. Don will beat him at open warfare. I think it's going to be interesting. I think he's had to become savvier to survive in America.
Savvier, exactly.
Yeah, I think one thing we mentioned earlier about how Trudy's kind of, you know, enlightened him at home and has his back at home, I'm looking forward to seeing if Lane's going to continue to have his back in the office. Because the way that Lane sort of assuaged Pete after his initial outburst was pretty brilliant. in terms of couching, in terms of you're pulling all the weight, Roger's a child, I'm doing this for you. And that seemed to put Pete sort of on, at least, you know, stop him in a way. And in a season that's throwing people together in really interesting combinations, a Lane-Pete sort of partnership slash mentorship, where, you know, he becomes sort of the Mr. Miyagi to his Danielson or something, something like that, could be, that's not something I would ever expect, although having seen it once, maybe it's because I want to see Lane Price as much as possible on my television screen.
I agree.
You know, I want Joan Rogers scenes, and I want a lot more Lane Price. And that's my wish for the rest of season four.
I can't argue with that.
It's Trudy, by the way, speaking of which, we've not had a lot of her.
She went back to community college.
Yeah, she's back to community college. No, I think Lane is great, and he's a great wild card in this mix because he is very astute and politically savvy. He's also the voice of reason. He's kind of the dad of the agency, telling people, you know, we can't do that, and that's not smart. But at the same time, he's taken this huge risk by taking a flyer with a new firm. His wife has left him over it. You know, his old way of life is over. So, but I think he's just the one thing that unites a lot of these characters, if not all of them, aside from the dreaded Betty, is that, you know, they have to make a go of this. But as we've been talking about, their modus operandi, their savviness levels, their astuteness at doing their jobs, all of that is really very much in flux, and sometimes the team is not all pulling together in the same direction. You know, sometimes they are, but, you know, this thing is not working as a finely tuned machine. It is up to a point. I mean, they are doing business. They are getting new clients. I think any new firm has a rocky first couple of years. That nothing strikes me as being, oh gosh, the wheels are coming off. But it's just a really, as James was saying at the very beginning of the podcast, it's been kind of a reset in a lot of ways. And to see people pulling for themselves and or pulling for the new firm, and sometimes those aren't the same things, it's been really interesting to watch.
Right, and now that we've got sort of Don hitting, if not rock bottom, close to rock bottom, we've got stuff going on the, you know, Draper slash household up in upstate New York, and now we've got Ken sort of back in the fold. We seem to have the pieces set for the second half of the season. Is this the part where Vietnam finally starts coming into play, or is that just too obvious a move in your estimation, James?
Well, they seem to be foreshadowing that with the talk with Greg earlier this season, saying that, you know, it's already on Joan's mind.
Right.
He was trying to assure her that, you know, he doesn't necessarily think that he's going off, but it's an open possibility. And historically, I believe, and I don't have Wikipedia open in front of me or anything, but so spring of 1965 is around when you have you start having you know, serious numbers of Americans being shipped over. So I don't know that becomes a major part of the season. I think that the direction we've been giving is that Vietnam is going to be coming up later in the season.
But
I wonder how they'll come at it, though. I mean, that's what's interesting about the show is that it did take on JFK's assassination, and, you know, there are mixed opinions about, you know, how it did so. And it certainly, some big events are just relegated to being mentioned sort of in passing. But I wonder if they'll come at it a different way. Like, you know, perhaps the firm prospers with defense clients. You know, perhaps, you know, they're drawn into it in ways we don't expect. So I'm curious to see how that affects the rest of the season, and or whether we'll kind of shove that off to one side until next season, because there's a lot going on right now, and obviously they have 7 more episodes to work through that, but I wonder, you know, really what they'll devote to, you know, the current array of problems and situations they have now.
Yeah, I mean, because season 2 was the Cuban Missile Crisis, and season 3 was JFK assassination, and those were events that everyone could feel acutely at the same time, but Vietnam's a different beast altogether. It's just sort of thing that's long drawn, slown out. It's going to accumulate weight over the series of time, and things are going to accumulate importance more so in retrospect than while they are actually happening. But it's just, it's unclear. It may be sort of a backdrop thing. I mean, they have been playing this generational gap all season, but that's the sort of, you know, the frustration and also the joy of Mad Men in a way, because some shows you can telegraph from, you know, minute one where they are going. It's just a matter of how are they going to get there. With Mad Men, you don't know how slow the pace of the show is because you don't know what the destination is. It's like the first time you go anywhere in your car.
Yeah.
You haven't driven there before. It's a lot easier coming back than it was getting there. In wrapping up here, so we talked a lot about this episode here. You talked earlier, James, about sort of your worry about where this season goes. What would be some of the things that could assuage those fears, and where do you hope the show goes, and what kind of issues it might address over the final seven episodes?
I'm not sure that I would call it worries. It's just that, you know, I don't really know what the season's building toward yet, and I just think that in a series like this, you can't really say after episode six whether season four is a failure or not. But I think that the thing that this season has to address in, I think, some sort of, if not climactic, but at least a dramatically satisfactory way, is John coping with the fallout from his divorce. I think that there's, you know, the season seems to be pointing towards some resolution on that front, because, you know, we've gotten things like, you know, Faye Miller's pronouncement to him the first time he met her, right? Are we going to see Don married again in another year? Faye, by the way, has been a very interesting, I think, to me, character this season, just being a woman who it seems at least to have Don entirely figured out. How does he get his life on course, if he does, by the time he's coming, you know, around on about the year anniversary of his split with Betty?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think, I don't know if you guys have ever come across this in your life, but that, you know, people get divorced, it's very ugly, and then suddenly, like, you know, 10 months later, that person's married again. And obviously, Betty wasted no time, and she was, you know, basically, I don't know, spent a day single, maybe, if that. I just wonder if Don will go that route and find somebody who is impressed by him, in a sense, you know, or, you know, just feels the Don Draper allure or mystique. That's been the whole battle of the show, really, is, you know, how can he sustain intimacy? Or maybe I'm just viewing it through my own personal lens, which is, I guess, how we all do it. But it's, how can he be who he is? And with, you know, as we've been talking about, he's got a huge amount of self-hatred, guilt. You know, there's loser Don that rears his head and takes him down a few notches whenever things are going too good. And, you know, how can he sustain any kind of interpersonal friendships, relationships, in the face of all of those issues that he has? And do we get a quickie marriage at the end of the season with some, you know, woman he's known for like a day, you know, 2 weeks, or is he still alone in that really scary little bachelor pad? I don't know. I find that place kind of dark and sad, and I'm sure that's by design.
Absolutely. So we'll obviously be watching as the season progresses. Thank you, everyone, for listening to this podcast, and a special thanks again to James Poniewozik from Time Magazine for coming on the podcast. Thanks so much, James.
Yeah, thank you,
James.
And everyone, make sure you're looking out for Mo's new website, debuting when?
It's Wednesday, the 1st of September. Go to television.aol.com, look for my byline. You can also, hopefully there'll be some kind of picture and or logo with my great column title, which is still to be determined, at tvsquad.com. So go either of those places and you'll find me.
Excellent. Definitely look forward to that. And again, look forward to another podcast from Mo and myself later in this week. But for now, take care and farewell.